Hooligan. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesay, and for the next hour or so, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage of choice, and settle in for the 30th episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos, and I'm broadcasting live from my home here in Harrisburg, South Dakota. It's wonderful to have you here with us, folks. 30 episodes. Seems like just yesterday. Well, before we get to the show today, I thought I'd give you all an update on the podcast throwdown for Halos of Hope. According to Nathania Apple from Perlis and Charns on Saturday, when I checked the group on Ravelry, Team Knitmore Girls still has a sizable lead on all the other teams. Here is the count so far. Team Knitmore Girls, 75 hats. Team Naughty Girls, 33 hats. And that is kind of a big jump from last week. So, you know, kudos, Naughty Girls. That's a nice jump. Team Craftlit, 6 hats. Team Sockaholic, 39 hats. Team Ready, Set, Knit is only showing 9 hats, but I have a feeling that's a reporting error. I'd like to invite you to go up to the boards and the next couple of days and make sure that that's still accurate. For all of you other Fiber Arts podcasters, please consider joining the Rumble. We'd love to have you create your own teams or join up with an existing team and join us for this great charity campaign. If you're curious about the Podcaster Throwdown, I'd like to invite you to join our Ravelry group, Podcaster Throwdown. We'd love to have your help with this campaign. And, you know, if you're looking for, you know, something cool to do, a charity knitting campaign, this is a good cause. As you know, Halos of Hope is near and dear to my heart, and I want to just do a quick shout-out to my dear friend Pam, the founder. And please keep listening to Fiber Hooligan. We'll try to have updates about the podcast to throw down at the top of every show. My guest today is British-trained knitwear designer. My guest today is a British-trained knitwear designer and has been designing commercially since graduating with a Bachelor's Arts in Fashion Knitwear Design from De Montfort University. Her original designs have been sold to major fashion houses in New York, London, and Paris for mass market production and have been widely published through premier knitting magazines such as Vogue Knitting International, Interweave Knits, and, of course, Knitters Magazine. She's also been published online at twistcollective.com. And you can find her patterns being carried by many leading yarn companies. She is the author of Inspired Cable Knits and Inspired Fair Isle Knits, both published by Pottercraft. She has an innate creative flair, a keen sense for developing trends and trend prediction, and also a unique talent for being able to communicate not only design ideas, but the principles of creativity. And she's just a lot of fun to talk to. I'm speaking, of course, of my friend, the very talented Fiona Ellis. Fiona joins us from Toronto, Ontario this morning. Good morning, Fiona, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. Congratulations, 30 episodes. That's wonderful.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it sometimes it seems like a lot, and sometimes it seems like just yesterday.
Sure.
I'm still doing it, so I obviously enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, it keeps you busy, right?
Yes, because I don't have very much to do these days anyway. So thank you for joining us. I guess I should say good afternoon, because at this point it's now just afternoon. And how are things in Toronto this fine morning?
Oh, beautifully sunny. A little chilly, but, you know, it is November. And, yeah, gorgeous sunshine. We always like to see the sun. So, yeah, it's beautiful this morning.
Well, that's great. It's a lovely day here. It's just sweater weather, but there's sun outside. I've got the windows open, and I never do that. I'm kind of a vampire. I like the dark, but I just needed just a touch of sunshine today.
Yeah,
so
I
understand.
I like the weather. Yeah, I should have said that.
Well, it's okay. So I understand that you just recently got back from Vancouver, a beautiful city, and had a chance to visit with our friend Steve Malcolm from It Takes Balls to Knit. How was your time with Steve?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Steve and I got together, and I actually, excuse me, sorry, he filmed a segment for his show, so which apparently has gone live this morning, although I've not had a chance to look at it, but hopefully I look good on it. I'm doing it.
I'm sure you were great on it, and I think we're going to declare this Fiona Ellis Day.
Yeah.
Know that some people in the Fiber Hooligan are stalking you. I can
live with that, you know. November 4th, yes, Fiona Ellis Day.
And as you pointed out,
every
year.
Before,
it happens every year, and it's the day before Guy Fawkes Day.
That's right, yes, but I don't want to be burned as an effigy, if that's at all possible.
We'll avoid that. But again, it's wonderful to have you with us. I do appreciate your time. I know you're getting busy and packing and getting things going, and we'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you on. So for our listeners that don't know that much about you, I'd like to start by giving them some background. And I'd like to start by really going back. You were born in England and you studied art and fashion. That's correct.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
All right.
Later on, though, I had a whole previous life before I did that.
Yes. Yes. Well, tell us about your previous life.
Okay. Actually, I worked as a cosmetic formulation scientist for around 8 years. And so I was responsible for formulating the colors for the latest season's lipsticks mostly. We worked with a design creative agency who would look at all the fashion trends and then come up with what the face is going to be, you know, looking like for that particular season. Because, of course, you know, we have to bear in mind what colors we're going to be wearing in terms of clothes and then match our colors accordingly. So I was responsible for, you know, coming up with some of the new colors, and I'm really, really good color matching on reds, oranges, and pinks because of that.
So you were responsible for people kissing each other?
Yeah. I still am. Actually, one of the things we looked at was if you were going to leave, you know, a lipstick mark, you know. No, let's not go there.
So a cosmetic scientist, and you did that before you were in the ready-to-wear world.
That's right, yes. I went back to university to De Montfort later on. I was a mature student, they like to call it, but I didn't feel that mature. I still don't. But so I had that whole, I call it my previous life because it is like a whole chapter that went before. But, of course, I still draw on it from, you know, the scientific approach to certain things when you're researching topics and that kind of stuff. And also the color matching was really where I started to train my eye to look at colors, you know, in more depth.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I don't know many schools, and I think this is worth talking about. You went to a school that actually taught knitwear as a part of the curriculum in the design department you were in.
Actually, that was the course. They had 5 or 6 different disciplines under the umbrella of the fashion school. So one of them would be straight fashion. So that was woven cloth fashion. I did fashion knitwear, but they also did lingerie, shoe design, print, and I'm forgetting something else. But so I specialized in knitwear for fashion industry. So it was a whole 3 years of studying everything to do with knitwear design.
Well, that's pretty incredible. I guess I wish there was more of those kind of courses available to the world.
It would be fabulous if it was. And I wouldn't mind going back and doing it again because, of course, once you have learned some knowledge, taking it back and then re-going through and, you know, because when you're in art school, you get to play around with things that, you know, crazy stuff that doesn't necessarily have to have a commercial end use. You don't have to bear that in mind. You can just be really off the wall and, you know, doesn't matter. You could be burning things, painting things, all sorts of stuff that, you know, in the regular magazine, you might not be suggesting to do that for the, you know, the knitter.
I agree. And my dear daughter is going to college right now, and she's an art major, and of course she's, you know, doing the art things, and, you know, she brings homework home, and I always find her art stuff the most fascinating. Sometimes I don't think she always thinks it's the most fascinating. You know, early art courses, as you know, are just like all gen ed courses. They try to get the basics done. But this seems pretty highly specialized, what you did. And it's got to be fun. The curriculum has got to be great.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, we still have those moments like every, you know, art student when you want to, you know, be setting the world alight with your, with whatever talent you think you have, and they're making you do these really very accurate kind of exercises. You don't, at the time, you don't really see the benefits of them because you want to go off and, you know, do something really wild and crazy, and, you know, they're making you look at stripes and how do we come up with really interesting stripes, for example. And it's one of the things that I draw on for my classes. I bring that, you know, to the classroom and say, you know, have everybody play with that idea because I now see how valuable that is. But, you know, when you're young and foolish, you know, you think you know it all.
Well, it's. I think that as we're younger, we do know it all. It's senility sets in sometime later. That's what I'm going to believe.
I'm sure you know more about that than me, Benjamin.
Okay.
Sorry. Deep shot. Sorry.
Got me, folks. She got me. Yep. Leave it to those Canadians. I tell you, I'm married to one. I know all about it.
I think I'm older than you. I should just back away from that now.
It's not the, I've always said that it's not the years, it's the mileage. It really is.
Right.
So I'm
okay.
Sure. So let's move into your foray into the ready-to-wear world. You were very successful in that world. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, for our listeners that don't know much about that world, you know, will you tell us about it? You know, we'd like to know how you got started and, you know, what you did and how that all worked.
Right. Well, basically what happens is that all of the big design houses, you know, right from the whole couture end right down to, you know, the people who are designing for, you know, a lower price point, They have in-house teams for the most part, but they like to have input from other designers and sort of fresh blood and fresh eyes. All of us can become kind of like set in a rut of how we design. So they buy in concepts from agencies. And so I had an agent who would rep not just my work, but a whole bunch of other designers, and she would go around to all the big fashion houses in Paris and London and New York and, you know, sell these concepts. And they basically, they take away this, you know, swatch, and it's a very large swatch. It's more like a mini front. I guess you should see Steve's show because I actually have visuals on that one so you can see how large they are. But they are basically like a little mini front with all of the details, you know, what the neckline's going to look like, you know, what the trims are going to be. It's not just a 4-inch gauge swatch or a stitch pattern or whatever. It's really, you've basically designed the whole garment. They buy that and then they're responsible for putting it into mass production. So they're basically buying ideas from designers.
Well, and you've done this agency work, but and your stuff has appeared in stores that we've heard of. Can you tell us about the end?
Yeah, I used to do very well with the Ralph Lauren women's wear line. My sensibility kind of fits really well with that aesthetic. But yeah, The Gap, Banana Republic, Anne Klein, I'm forgetting some. And it was all done anonymously. They buy the design and they pay you handsomely for that. And then they put it into production. So they're doing a lot of the hard work. You're just coming up with the really, you know, the creative part of it. Yeah.
And did you do any of the couture at all?
Some lower end couture, so not the real full on runway stuff. I think a lot of times the you know, the designer would be, whose name is on that house, would be responsible for most of the idea generated there. So not that I'm aware of, but I think it's because I've always been possibly a little bit more commercially minded, because of my schooling background was designed to, you know, educate people who could go out and work in industry, not just be, you know, sit on a mountaintop and dream up fanciful ideas. It was much more practical than that. So I think my design work is very much about, you know, how do you actually put it into manufacturing? And, you know, you would be bearing in mind the fact that 24 stitches is a magic number in the knitwear industry, because it's divisible by so many others. So if you have a repeat that fits into 24 stitches, it makes the life of the, you know, the manufacturer so much easier than if you've suddenly given him 25 stitches. So bearing all that knowledge in mind is what makes you successful, because it's a lot easier for them to do their job afterwards. But it was also, you know, that is not tending to lead itself into these really, you know, wacky things, which I guess is why I'd like to go back and do some of that.
Well, eventually you found your way into the fiber arts world, mm-hmm. and it's a good story. I know it. So I'm going to ask you to tell our listeners how that happened. What was your big break into the fiber arts world, and how did that happen?
So through my agent, I met Tricia Malcolm, who's the editor of Vogue Knitting magazine, and they also will buy some concepts from the agencies, but they prefer much more to work directly with the designers. So I had met Tricia, and she is wonderful, and she is so, she's like an amazing sort of facilitator, that she will hook people up with other people who can be useful in your career and what have you. But I booked an interview with her, sort of a meeting with her, and took along my portfolio, and I, you know, had got all this prep that I was, what I was going to say to her, and I said, I would like to submit to you. Is that going to be okay? And she's like, sure it is, of course. You know, you know, she had seen my work, so she looked through my portfolio and sort of gave me some direction and some input, and she basically gave me a laundry list of, you know, these are the people to contact. Just go away and, you know, and that's kind of how it launched. So my first published designs in the fiber arts world were three designs for Vogue Knitting, and I forget which issue it was. So that was kind of like, ooh, right in at the deep end, you know? It was great.
Well, I think you're right about Trish Malcolm. She really is an exceptional person, and I know that she goes way out of her way not to just hire, but also to make introductions to other people. I mean, she's always been
Of
a good person. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's amazing.
And I understand you were in the 30th anniversary for Vogue?
Yes, I was so thrilled with that. I got a phone call one afternoon from Trish herself, and she said, you know, we're putting together this story about, you know, a take on the modern, the ode to Aran. So looking at the Aran sweater, but how do we look at it in our contemporary world rather than just, you know, putting together another really great Aran sweater. And she said, we're calling on the people that we feel, you know, have really worked hard and have made a name in the cabling technique area. And she said, I'm sending you yarn. We'd like you to cable this something. So I'm like, wow, that's really cool. And then you're sort of that moment of panic of like, shoot, what do I come up with? You know, this is a big deal. It's their anniversary issue. You know, they've selected, Trisha's hand selected a few designers to do this. And then I'm like, okay, get over yourself and just, like, you know, do what you have done before. You can't suddenly be something that you're not, so you just have to rely on the work that you've already done, which is presumably what she has admired. So I kind of took that idea, and basically what I did was I took the idea of the Aran sweater is usually, you know, one large cable flanked by ever-decreasing smaller ones, and I've... I haven't already told you this one, but Benjamin, but you know how I'm a really messy eater, and I'm always spilling things on myself, and I always wish that you could just kind of, like, scoot your top around so that, you know, the spaghetti stain is not, like, front and center anymore. So I did that with the design. So I took the sweater. I didn't put the drop spaghetti on it. I just moved everything off to one side and made it very asymmetrical, so the patterning runs around onto the back, and it's not all just on the front.
Well, that's very clever.
That's
very clever. You know, it's funny that you talk about that angst. I've talked to many designers, and they get, you know, a yarn company or a magazine that says, hey, will you do this thing for me? And they get excited, and they say, sure. And then they hang up the phone and do the, oh, dear gosh, what am I going to do? I have a feeling that first comes the enthusiasm and then comes the, you know, the panic. I think that's pretty typical of creative people, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think it's because you want to do your best. And I think you also think that this is a moment that, you know, the spotlight is on and you want to come up with something that's really fabulous. And, you know, it's a different way of working than I've already worked out my ideas and I submit them to the magazine or yarn company and they say, yes, we like that one, let's go with it. the angst has already taken place and you have decided before you send it out, this is a little bit more in the reverse, that you suddenly go, shoot, what do I have that's good enough? And I see all creative people suffer from that kind of angst, yeah. But you just have to, like, okay, I could either sit in the corner and panic about it, or I can, you know, get on with it and actually do it. And so, you know, that was more my attitude in the end.
Well, I think even non-creative people suffer from angst. Someday we'll sit down and we'll do an angst contest, and I'm not all that creative, but I win. I do.
Yes.
I worry about everything.
I think it's the same. Whenever you're doing something that is very close to your own personal ideas, you angst about, you know, how it's going to be perceived and is it going to be good enough and, you know, in everything. And all jobs, it doesn't have to be necessarily labeled that creative thing, you know, for people to, if you really want to do a good job, then I think you get a little anxious about, are you doing a really good job and are you doing your best?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody just posted in the chat room, Benjamin's angst is the Doctor Who scarf, isn't it? You know, it's always good when I'm on the show to have people pick on me about my scarf. It means that the Piper Hooligans love me, I think. That's what
it
means.
Yeah, well, you know, that's that whole thing. In England, you know, we only actually tease the people that we care about. You know, if you're not interested in somebody, you don't poke fun at them. It's kind of a way of showing affection, but, you know.
Yes. Yes. Well, and I've seen that, you know, most of my friends don't have trouble expressing themselves that way. But we won't go into me right now. we'll move on. So you've also designed for most of the magazines, including Knitters Magazine, and a lot of yarn suppliers, little yarn companies, large yarn companies. And I'd like to talk about some of the yarn companies you've done design work for and how that works, because as you know, you and I both know, and maybe our listeners don't, there is no way, one way to work with a yarn company to produce designs for them.
Right. And that's when it becomes really important to know what their product is, because basically the design work in that instance is as product support, because, you know, you go into a yarn store and you see this fabulous yarn, you need to give knitters a way of seeing what is possible with that yarn. So that's the role of an independent designer, is to come up with, again, I guess it's a little bit like the ready-to-wear, like a different way of seeing how you can use that yarn. I've taken some things that have been really, you know, a standard yarn that is supposed to be for children's wear and, you know, made it very contemporary and fashion forward for women's wear. And, you know, sometimes the supplier goes, whoa, I would never have seen it like that. And that's kind of why they're using us to come up with new and interesting, tantalizing ways of using their product so that people want to buy it.
And there's a cycle to that as well. I mean, you know, yarn companies actually need to switch designers up every so often so that there's fresh and looks. I mean, that just has to happen.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Go ahead. I was going to say.
Oh, we got into that one. You first. I was going to say that it continues like that, so that you know, I work with a yarn company for a while, and then I move on and work with another yarn company, and so on. So it's not that, you know, you're not friends with them anymore. It's just, like you said, that they need to bring in new and fresh, interesting ideas constantly. And if they continue to work with just one independent designer, then you would get that rut forming anyway, so...
And I agree. And it works differently with different yarn companies. I mean, one of the things that I love talking about is the nature of yarn companies, because most yarn companies are really very smallish. It's usually a family biz. I mean, there's a couple, but even the big yarn companies, it's usually a small team. And most of the higher end yarn companies tend to be a family biz that, you know, is really pretty smallish. And they're quirky, and I say that in the best of ways, because you work with XRM. We're a quirky little family company.
Yeah.
You know that, too. Do you have any funny stories that, you know, don't make anybody look bad, but that are interesting?
I'm just trying to think. I've had some crazy things of, you know, like when yarn's being shipped to me. Last year I was on a big tour with my husband's company was doing this sort of big promotional tour. And he's a scientist. He's not a rock star or anything. But so I was kind of on the road with him for about 3 months. And I would say, okay, can you ship the yarn to this hotel for this day? And if it doesn't make it, it's going to be toast, you know. So it has to be. So there's a lot of juggling going on. And because you're working with a small team, you can say this. You're not having to then put it into a big system where somebody's, you know, crunching numbers and what have you. You're speaking to probably the owner of the company who's going to, you know, ask the person sitting next to them, can you please just mail this to Fiona and make sure it gets there on this day? Otherwise, she's going to be gone. But I don't think I have any really stories I can share on air about the,
okay.
Maybe over a beer, Benjamin.
Okay, all right, yeah. This will be the closed paper version of Barbara Hood. Everybody has to swear not to speak about it afterwards. Yep, I've often thought about inside Barbara Hooligan show where people air their but no, I don't want to be the,
let's not go there.
Let's not go there. We'll do it over a beer. So, can you talk about any big milestones? Was there one instance where you had just a big breakthrough with a yarn company that your name really got out there?
Not a yarn company, but being associated with the Twist Collective, I feel like that was a pivotal point in the industry as well as my career. And, you know, fortunately, Kate Gilbert, who's the creative brains behind Twist Collective, brought me, not on board exactly, it's a collective, we all kind of get involved and share a lot of roles within that. She really uses me just as a designer, but I have input. She runs things by me. You know, I'm thinking of doing this. How do you think the designers will take this? And she asked for sort of input once she could come up with the initial idea right from the get-go. And then I was actually fortunate enough to be on the cover of the premiere issue. So I was thrilled about that. And that one still, I get a big buzz out of that. But I'm like, yay, not only a cover, but for a premiere issue for something, that was a big deal.
Well, since we're talking about that, let's talk a little more about the Twist Collective, because that's a big showcase of your work. I think you've been in almost every edition of it.
I've been in every issue,
And it's not just, again, you're not just designing for them, you're collaborating. And you have some very nice things to say about the process and the people that you work with. And I'd like to give you a chance to talk to our listeners a little bit about that process.
Yeah, it's an amazing team. One of the things as a designer that we need is, you can't do everything, all of the roles, completely by yourself. And you do need to have a really, really good tech editing team. And that's one of the things that I really love about Twist Collective is that they spend a lot of time and effort making sure that the patterns are as accurate as they can possibly be. And Sandy Rosner is the one who heads up the tech editing team as well as being a designer, so she can do both. But we always need someone to be tech editing our own work. And you feel like you're in really safe hands, like her input is making your pattern instructions just that bit better. And, you know, that's one of the things that I have learned. Working with really good tech editors informs your writing skills and, sort of cognitive skills about putting together instructions. So that's been a huge, huge bonus over the last 5 years working with that team. Kate Gilbert has the most amazing aesthetic, and I'm always, like, blown away when I see the issue because the photography is just so beautiful. And knitwear design, we're looking at aspirational things, so we want to look at things and go, oh, aren't they beautiful, I really want to make that. And she does a fabulous job with that.
Well, I'm a big fan of what they do as well, and as you know, I'm a big fan of Sandy Rosner's. We've spoken about her in the past, and she's an incredible lady and just a nice person too. Down-to-earth person. But I want to talk, we're going to skip out of order here a little bit from what we had originally kind of planned, but I want to talk about the nature of the collaborative process that goes between editors, tech editors, and getting things right, because this is really an important process that I know that you get, and you're good at explaining how this works. Designers, even great designers that can do good tech editing, need that feedback from a communication standpoint. And yeah. oftentimes, you know, even with the best of tech editing, there is errata afterwards. And yeah. people can use that with a mistake. Sometimes it can be a mistake, but oftentimes it's just a better way of saying something. And I know you've got a lot of appreciation for people that can help you with that. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, that's one of the other things that a tech editor can do, that you know what you mean. Okay, do XXX, you know, whatever, and this is what happens. The sleeve comes out this shape. But you already know because you've done it. You've had your test knitter check it, and you've worked with her. You know, they actually are all female, my test knitters. But then you pass it out into the outer world. You don't have that ability to go, well, this is what I mean, and, you know, I don't like overly wordy instructions because sometimes then you get lost in all of that. And sometimes it can just be the way something is laid out on the page. And, you know, a break in a line can mean that you don't see it or whatever it is. And oftentimes the questions that I get about my patterns will be, let me just walk you through this, and then you get the note back going, oh, I see, I haven't seen that comma, or I haven't seen that knit two together, or whatever it is. Your eyes just skipped over it. And, you know, having people slow down and work through an instruction. And so having somebody look at that and look at the layout and the wording and all of this kind of thing is really, really important because you can't edit your own work because you already know what you mean to say. So you can't see how it could be misread. Yeah.
Well, and I believe that as well. You can't edit your own work. I can't tell you the number of times where I've written something and somebody in my office said, really? And I, you know, went over it four times. And again, that's not, and the stuff I write is not difficult like instructions for garments. I mean, that's difficult stuff. And there sometimes is more than one way to read that. But it's good. It's good that you go through this. And again, I want to give a shout out to Sandy Rosner, who's, you know, great at that.
Yes, she's really, you know, one of the best in the industry, and I love that I get to work with her, and I've learned a lot from her, as well as, you know, knowing that I'm in good hands and safe hands. And, you know, when she comes back to me and she goes, no, I don't agree, let's do it this way, I'm inclined to go, yeah, okay, we'll go with what you think, Sandy, because, you know, she thinks a lot about this, and so you know that her advice is good.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's always a give and take, and the creative process sometimes becomes slightly adversarial, and there's not a bad thing as long as people make sure that they keep their manners about them.
Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah. Yes, manners are very important.
But you know, you're a Canadian, so we expect you to be polite anyway, right?
Of course, yes, yes.
Of course, always.
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 Yeah, I
all right, so... Oh, please, go ahead.
Go ahead. I know I was just going to say something else about, I think manners are really, really important, and it's something that we seem to forget a lot of times. You know, that blunt email that you just bounce out, and you're like, what happened to good morning? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I believe it too. All right, let's move on to the next piece of your world that I want to talk about. Eventually, you made the transition from being a designer that was working with yarn companies and magazines to Twist Collective, of course. And you made that transition to being a book author with your first book, Inspired Cable Knits, published by Potter Craft. Can you tell us about how that came about?
Yeah, and I guess it's one of those things that, you know, it's still ongoing. It's not like a linear thing, but, you know, actually Twist Collective came after the book, but, you know, I'm splitting hairs a little there. But I have so many ideas that I really don't know kind of what to do with them a lot of times. I know that I work in series, so I'll have like an idea. I'm like, okay, let's, and then explore it from as many different avenues as I can dream up, which means I generate, you know, a ton of ideas. And not always does, you know, a yarn company or a magazine want to use multiples of those. They want one of them. So I had a bunch, and I thought, well, you know, it would be kind of neat to put them in as a collection in a book. thinking that this will be a way of, like, you know, using up some of my ideas. But of course, what happens is that then, as you're working, you're generating new ideas as you go as well. So I still have a bunch, and I still have some that I know were generated for the book, which didn't make it into the book, so they're still out there, and some of them are yet to find homes. They haven't found quite the right place, and sometimes they're the ones that, even though they're really good, they're not the best ones. There's something else that was a little bit better, or for whatever reason, and they sort of, you know, sit in my stash of swatches that I use for teaching tools now. Where was I going? Oh yes, the book. So that's kind of one of my impetus to actually, you know, write a book. The other one was that, you know, that whole idea of something that is beyond you, that, you know, it exists externally to you and will do forever, and you have an ISBN number and it's yours and that's it, and, you know, after I'm gone it will still be around, hopefully in some form or other. So there was that aspect too. I also wanted to put together material that wasn't just about the pattern instructions. So I didn't want to do a book that was just like a booklet of patterns. I wanted some, like, personal writing in there, and sort of some of the thoughts and some of my process behind the designs that were contained in there. So it has little written pieces. Both of the books have written pieces that go alongside the pattern instructions.
Well, the book is great, and I've said it many times, and I've said it on the air before. The books that stand the test of time are not just pattern books. They contain something of the author, a sensibility, a sense of empowerment, a sense of, you know, yes, you can do this, and also some mental tools that help people be creative. And please don't get me wrong, there are some beautiful patterns in your book. I think there's 20 patterns in your book. But you also spend, as you said, a great deal of time in your book with your thoughts and almost journal notes, providing encouragement to the readers to try other things than what you provided them. Can you talk about that sensibility?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really, really, I don't know, I think of it being my role in life, just, you know, even beyond my design work, that to inspire people to do, make creative acts, be it, you know, in this case, sweaters and knitwear and what have you. But I'm one of those crazy people at a cocktail party who will take people on one side, and I get them to tell me what their dreams are, and then I, you know, okay, now I'm custodian of that, and I encourage them to follow some of those dreams. So be careful what you tell me. But I try to encourage creativity and it be about a personal expression and drawing from someone's knowledge. And that could be something that I don't have knowledge of, but they draw upon that and then bring that into whatever creative pursuit they're, you know, in. So that was kind of what I was trying to get at with their mindfulness pointers, that I, you know, things to ponder and think about while you're, you know, contemplating while you're knitting.
Well, and I've looked through the book as well, and I've talked to many authors about this. You know, when you're putting that kind of, here are my thoughts and here's the way that I think you should approach these things and here's some things that you should be considering and here's some things that I thought along the way, what you're putting together is very personal. In a way. I mean, you're exposing yourself it's a huge piece of exposure, and you throw that out there into the world, and it's not like, you know, just a pattern which somebody may say yay or nay to. You know, when somebody likes or doesn't like your book and you put that much of you into it, you're incredibly exposed.
Exactly, yes, and it's a scary place.
It's a scary place.
Yeah. When it was about to be launched, the cable book, I had a meeting with my publishers, and over dinner I was expressing this, that, you know, it had already gone to print, but I was like, oh, I'm like, oh, the angst again, right? You know, I've written all these personal things, what if people think I'm an idiot, or what if, you know, and all of this. And anyway, most of the team were extremely supportive, and they're saying, you know, we've read it all, it's beautiful, da-da-da-da, what have you. But my editor took a completely different tack, and it was so helpful. She said, it's already in print. Get over it. There's nothing you can do about it. I'm like, okay, yep, that's good. Because you've already committed it. It's already out in the world. It, just because it hasn't reached the hands of knitters, it, you know, there's no taking it back at this point. So you should have thought about that before you did it, I guess. That was really helpful, you know. You know, sort of metaphorical, kind of like, you know, giving you a punch and go, come on, you know. Get over it.
Little tough love. Little tough love. Yeah. Yeah, well, there's nothing like, you know, don't worry about it. There's nothing. Yes, you know, the die is cast, as they say.
Yeah, I think I need that, that whole kick in the, you know, the pants to say, oh, come on, get over yourself and, you know, get on with the next piece. And, you know, and yeah. And then she said, you know, what about the next book?
Well, and I know enough about authors that go do these big things. After a book is published, there is a physical and an emotional drain that they really need to go away, just sleep for a while. Are you that person?
Yes. Whenever I submit a manuscript, I mean, it happens with any time you do a big collection of work, but a book particularly, and I think it's 3 days to sleep it off. And I was surprised. My second book, I thought, oh, well, I've done this. You know, I should be able to take this more in my stride. Maybe I'll take, you know, half a day and what have you. But no, it's 3 days of just, like, complete exhaustion. And, you know, you just don't know what to do with yourself. And there's no tech editing patterns in that because you would be – your brain's really fried.
So I want to talk about that moment because I've been privileged to be with a number of authors in that moment where they saw their book printed and it was in their hands for the very first time. For you, you weren't with your publisher when it happened. They sent you a FedEx package. Can you talk about that moment?
Yeah, I was alone in my kitchen, and the FedEx man, you know, dropped it off, not knowing that, you know, what he was handing to me was like this culmination of, you know, a huge chunk of work and what have you. And you kind of open it up, and you know, I was trembling. I looked down at my hands where I was actually shaking. And I was really kind of shocked by that. And I don't really know what that emotion was. It was sort of, it felt a little bit like fear or nerves or whatever, but just also that amazement that you've created this. And I mean, I still have that buzz whenever I've created something that, you know, is in my mind's eye, and then I do all this work and it goes out into the world and you're like, wow, it looks exactly like I imagined it. But then a collection, a whole book of that is just overwhelming. But I don't really know how you describe it. It's just this amazing moment of, like, I don't know. I don't actually know what the emotion is. There should be a name for it.
I think there should be. We're going to work on that name. But I've been there to see it. And, you know, you're very fortunate. It not every author opens their book up for the first time and are able to say, gosh, that's exactly how I want it presented. And, you know, and you were, and I think we should give some kudos to Pottercraft for getting
absolutely,
that done.
Absolutely, yes, yes. Yeah. You know, that's another thing when you're part of a team that are putting together that, and their vision for how the book was going to look was totally in sync with what I was hoping. So it was, you know, it was fabulous. But, yeah, I can't imagine. It must be really, really disappointing if you open it and it's not how you'd imagined it. And it's very neat when, because you've seen the galleys and everything, and you at that point you're checking everything and looking for, you know, mistakes or, you know, making sure that all the numbers add up and what have you. But when it's actually bound and it's a real book, it's something else, you know? Yeah.
It's very much something else. And then there's that moment, and, you know, I've got friends that have gone through that, and you have got the book, and you've sweated, and you've gone through the galleys, and tons of tech edit people, and you open it up, and within 15 minutes, you found a mistake.
I think mine was just a tad longer. I think I just decided I was going to bask in it for the rest of the afternoon.
I think mine
was probably, you know... I forget what there's just a couple in there. Oh, I know what, I forgot to include a full description of an increase and a decrease that I've used in one of the patterns. And it's on my website now, but, you know, that was, I mean, like, I cannot believe that one got past, you know.
Well, and you and I both know it does not matter how long you edit a book, how many times you see it. There is no such thing as a manuscript that goes out without a mistake. It's just not possible.
Right, because it's all of the people involved are human. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And it's something that you know you really beat yourself up about when when one is spotted and you're like, oh, no, you know, I really should have. And, you know, all of us, I don't know anybody who puts out pattern instructions who doesn't beat up on themselves when we find, you know, however small the error is, we think we should have been, you know, better. We should have been able to find it. But it happens. But it doesn't mean we sit back and go, oh, well, it's going to happen anyway. we go through this.
No. I like to tell people
it.
That. Yeah, I like to tell people that, but I've never seen a designer that doesn't carry some, oh my gosh, and just almost mortified by that. And
yeah,
a lot of that has to
like
do with it. They don't want to inconvenience, you know, their customers.
Yeah,
they just don't.
For sure. It's like this. It's like your stomach just rolls over, and you're like, oh no. And I sometimes sit with, you know, anything that I'm sending out, and you like, I almost put my hand on it and go, just show me where you are. I know you're in there somewhere. I haven't found you yet. Just tell me where you are. And, of course, you know, it doesn't happen like that. But, you know, in Harry Potter it would. You could wave your magic wand and that rogue number would show itself.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, but the book did come out, and it was very successful, and it led to another book, also published by Pottercraft. And this was Inspired Fair Isle Knits. It has very much the same voice as your first book.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that book?
Yeah, that was interesting. I'd when we were discussing this earlier, I had forgotten to mention that when I knew it was going to be called Inspired Fair Isle Knits because, you know, the other one was Inspired Cable Knits, but I had to give it its working title that was completely different so that I could kind of approach it as a completely separate entity. And the research that I put into this was rather than these little contemplations was I actually researched stories and supporting material based on each chapter is based on an element. So I looked for stories that were spoke about fire and earth and water and so on. So I did some fabulous, like, you know, reading around of like native stories about, you know, how the world came into being and you know, all sorts of material that, you know, researching the history of different dye stuffs and coloring and, you know, all this kind of stuff that goes in there. So it's supportive material, but in a different way, but hopefully it has the same kind of thought-provoking, I hope. You know, that was kind of what I was aiming for.
Yes, I think you were very successful in that. You told me about an inspiration where a common fan of this particular artist. Did you want to bring that into it?
Sorry, could you say that again, Benjamin? Please.
We are both a fan of an artist that you drew some inspiration on.
Oh yes. Actually, he's my current obsession du jour. But yes, the whole David Bowie thing. I joke that I have these little series. You know how Picasso had his blue period? I have, you know, times where I go through tree bark or, you know, whatever it is, and there's a Bowie era coming on, you know, so I shall bore everybody talking about how fabulously creative he is. Looking at that, so that doesn't make it into this book, but watch this space is what I'm going to say. I'm returning to color and playing with sort of stranding work and inspired by Bowie's work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, incredibly talented guy.
Oh, I'm in complete awe of him. And yeah, I have been in love with him since I was 11. So I'm fiercely loyal, you know.
Well, good for you. I like that.
I have a little one I want to add about the book. It was really funny that, you know, oftentimes when you're chit-chatting with people, and I was at the gym one time and this lady asked me what I did, and I said, oh, you know, I design sweaters and I'm an author. And she said, an author? Wow, do you mean like J.K. Rowling? I'm like, yeah, just like her, except my knitting books are better than hers. And her bank account is probably better than mine. But I just thought,
well,
this is a reference. I'm like, wow, I'm thrilled.
Well, but you have to ask yourself, okay, yes, she's slightly more successful, you know, in the book world, but does she have her own day?
Oh, quite, yes. Well, I'm sure
she has.
Do
you have
her
own day? Let's get real.
I wonder if she can knit, though. See, that is magic, right?
That is magic, absolutely.
Yeah.
So at some point, you got started teaching, and, of course, you've for Stitches before. I've seen your class reviews, and I know that you're a remarkable teacher. Can you talk about how you kind of got into teaching?
That goes back to that first conversation I had with Tricia Malcolm. It was one of the things that she suggested that I look into doing. And, I'm one of these my father taught me that, you know, you ask people nicely and what's the worst they can say is no. And generally speaking, people, if they're going to say no, they say nicely anyway. So I just ask, you know, can I please teach at your event? Or, and I started at the Creative Festival here in Toronto, and that was my first kind of foray into that. But my teaching, I tend to go look at it from a, you know, personal development creative standpoint. So even though I'm going to underpin it with technical input, it's really about how do we use these tools in our, you know, our knitting itself, rather than I'm just going to give you all the nuts and bolts of the technicalities. It's like how do we leap off that and use it, add it to our box of tools.
Well, and you've extended yourself into, because it's one thing to sit in front of a room at a creative festival or, you know, a Vogue Live or a Stitches and teach, but you've extended past that. You're also a Craftsy.com instructor. I believe you have two classes on Craftsy. One's a paper class and one is a free class. I've had other Craftsy instructors on the show. So can you tell us a story about how you got hooked up with the gang from Denver and what your experiences was like with them?
Oh, well, another great team. You're in really, really great hands there. And that's actually, from a teaching point of view, that's really very interesting because you're teaching to a camera, so you don't have any of that, you know, sort of eye contact or that glazed look, okay, they didn't get what I was just saying, or, you know, feedback on, you know, nobody laughs at your jokes. That's really, you know, kind of demoralizing. But so it's a completely different thing than doing it with actual live people. But it was kind of a neat thing. This tour that I was saying I was with my husband. We had dinner with a bunch of his colleagues, and again, I was explaining what I did. And this one woman who I just met said, "Wow, do you have a Craftsy class?" She's a quilter and what have you. And she said, "Do you have a Craftsy class?" I'm like, "No, I don't, but I do mean to kind of contact them." And then that was on a Saturday. On a Tuesday, I had lunch with Felicia Lowe from Sweet Georgia Yarns, and she had just recorded her Craftsy class. And so I was asking her the lowdown on, you know, what was her experience like and what have you. And I get back to my hotel room from having lunch with Felicia, and there is an email from Stephanie Chappell saying, "Would I be interested in filming a Craftsy class?" I'm like, "Well, if that's not a sign, I don't know what is," you know. So I wrote to her straight away and said, "Yes, please, I would love to, you know, talk to you about that." And then, you know, you're into the whole system, and they have a really amazing way of working through, you know, the whole protocol that gets you to filming the class and it being launched. It was, you know, it was really fabulous. I had a really great experience with them.
Well, your classes up there are very successful. Of course, you know, you do have a free class up there, and you've got a lot of people that have taken that class.
I have, yes. And I always joke that I'm glad I don't have to grade their papers. Yeah, I have 37,000 people signed up for the free class. So, yes, amazing exposure. And I hope that they're all, you know, gaining something really good from every one of them, you know.
Well, I think they are. Otherwise, people wouldn't be signing up for it. And, folks, I want to explain something about the nature of Craftsy classes in case you haven't seen them. Craftsy classes are such that there is an interface for a Craftsy class where you can talk to other people taking the class, but also have feedback back and forth with the instructor. So regardless of whether, you know, this is not a class where you just simply take a video, put it out there, and you walk away from it. This is something that, even though it's free, you're maintaining almost on a daily basis, I would imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I check in every day unless, you know, I'm off traveling or on vacation or something. I check in every morning to see if there are questions. And if there's a promotion running, then I'll check maybe in the evening as well. And so that way, you know, I want to keep on top of if there are questions being asked. And I also don't want people to have to wait for the reply. So I try and get on that as quickly as possible. And the other neat thing is that once that reply or the question and the reply are posted, they're up there for everybody to see. So you don't have to keep answering the same question over and over. So sometimes we can get into some really neat dialogues where everybody is kind of involved, and it's been some really fabulous stuff come out of that.
Can you tell our Fiber Hooligan listeners what your two classes are?
Now this is when I'm going to forget the names. So Creative Cable Necklines, is the free class, and then Mastering Cable Design is the paid-for class. And I'm looking at the different techniques that I use for designing cables in that one. You see, I should have really remembered the name, because it's one of the things that you do when you're recording, that you end an opening class with the title and, welcome back. And remember, I could remember my own name, but, there were moments where two classes, three words each, I could get every combination of those six words mixed up and, fluff the title, and you have to then start again.
Well, that's great. So Fiber Hooligans, the other one, I think, is Mastering Cable Design is your paper class.
It is, yes.
Right.
Cable. And
those?
How to design cables and, what they are, and then, how would you, different techniques that I use. And the Neckline class is really, even though it's focused on cables, it has a lot of information there that I think is really important for everyone to understand about how to really make the finesse or the couture details on your garment makes or breaks a project. And so some interesting ideas, I hope, for people to think about when they're deciding on what kind of trims, necklines, cuffs, and that kind of thing that they're with for their own projects.
Well, and since it's Fiona Ellis Day, I would invite you all to get up to Craftsy and take a look at her classes.
Yeah. Drop me a line and say hello while you're there.
Drop me a line and say hello. Because, yes. All right. Since we're talking about your teaching, we elephant in the room, we should probably talk about your Stitches East experience this week. It's wonderful to have you back with us as a teacher at Stitches in Hartford, Connecticut. And you're teaching classes as well as being part of our opening day presentation with Barry Klein and Cornelia Tuttle Hamilton. This is a design challenge based on interpreting the Lady Raglan. Will you tell us about this?
Yeah. How much do you need me to talk about it, though? Because we do want people to show up and actually, see the presentation as well. But I'm guessing that Barry and Cornelia have also, devised their presentation on kind of the process that we went through designing the garment that is going to appear in the winter issue of Knitters. And so I talk about all of the research that I did, sort of looking at Lord Raglan and kind of like my muse of who I would design the garment for. And then I talk about, the technicalities of why I chose the color I chose. Some technical input on the cable. Gosh, it's got cables on it. Can you imagine? I've given this away now. But, and I was really drawing from this whole idea of Lord Raglan being in the military, and I took military braids for my inspiration. But what I wanted to do was make it. It's called Lady Raglan, so I wanted it to be a very ladylike, elegant, feminine garment. So I'm doing that juxtaposition of something that has, this strong, powerful, masculine kind of tendency, and how do we make that super ladylike and feminine? And I'm really, really proud of the garment. It's one of those as a culmination of a lot of stuff that I've been working on that comes together in this one, and so I'm super proud of it.
Well, I've seen the pictures, and I think you have every right to be proud of it. I'm looking forward to being there with you and seeing, the three of you, your very different takes on this. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Great opening day presentation.
I think that's what's really interesting is that we, all of us can come from, you have this one brief, but we all come at it from, with our own experiences and our own knowledge and expertise, and all come up with something that we're proud of and that hopefully that the, knitters will also want to make. So.
I think they will. I absolutely think they will. Besides the opening day, of course, you are teaching some classes, and for the benefit of our Fiber Hooligans that are coming to Stitches East, can you tell us about your classes?
I'm doing a couple on cables, which is kind of surprising, I think. or not. And then I'm doing an all-day color class, so I'm looking at some of those things I was talking about earlier, that I'm drawing on the things that I did in school, in art school, and looking at, you know, how do we choose colors, where do we look for inspiration, and then some of the techniques that we use when we're doing color work, so Farrow, Intarsia, slip stitch, that kind of thing. And then I have a class on creativity, and, you know, really kind of, there's some exercises in there, but also drawing a little bit on what I included in the cable book on some of those practices that you put into your daily life to, you know, come up with more creative ideas.
So you've got a pretty full agenda.
Yeah. As always.
Are you
all instructors do.
Yes. Well, yes, they really do. I mean, it's for those of you who haven't been to a show, there really is a lot going on all the time. I come back from these shows exhausted, I think I treat it just like a book. I sleep for 3 days. I just can't.
I sleep for a day. I'm sure, you know, those of you who are organizing it, it's the same as the book. Yeah, 3 days is kind of what you need.
Yes, that's what I need.
So much, you know, energy and input that we take in that, you know, you have to be able to kind of process that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's such a condensed experience. I don't know, are you doing any book signings within the market throughout the weekend?
No, I don't think I am this time. But, you know,
okay.
Trip me up in the hallway and I'll certainly sign something.
Okay, good. I'm sure your books will be on sale in the market. So, yeah. And folks, since you know that Fiona's going to be there, I'm sure I think we're actually organizing a stalkers group for you, so it might be easier to find you.
Oh, great. Is Tammy heading
that
up?
I think that Tammy and Steve are working on, you know, a GPS system for you, so it'll be easier to stalk. And if nothing else, and we got to talk about her, I can't have you on the show and not talk about her. We have a mutual friend, a very good friend of both of ours, and it would just be wrong to not talk about her. I'm speaking, of course, of Betsy Hirschberg. And, you know, for those of you who are interested in Betsy Hirschberg, who does wonderful bead knitting and a lot of other cool things, she will be on the show in early December.
Let's talk about
Betsy, because I know that you and she are thick as thieves.
We are. That was a marriage made in heaven, whoever, you know, hooked us up to become roommates. And, you know, we come again from completely different sort of backgrounds in you know, our approach. And, you know, yeah, we sit up late at night talking about ideas. I love Betsy. She's just so inspiring to me that we just, you know, gab about ideas and, you know, and stuff. And it's been an amazing, amazing thing to get to know her and get to sleep with her as well. You know? Not in the same bed. Same room, but not the same bed. And of course, I can say this because I know she'll be too polite to tell people on air, but it turns out I'm the bad roommate, not her. She's, you know, she doesn't have any bad habits and stuff, but, you know, I have on one occasion ended up, you know, using her toothbrush by mistake. And she still shares a room with me. Fortunately, I had a brand new one in my bag that I could give to her.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. No, she's pretty amazing. And, you know, one of the things that I think is an interesting comparison between the two of you is that you're very much a creative in what I would consider a traditional sense from what I know about creatives, which is, you know, the right-brained creative. And Betsy, of course, will go on a large rant about the difference between right brain and left brain, and she considers herself to be a left brain. In other words, not somebody that's traditionally an artist. And that's going to make for some interesting conversations between the two of you.
Oh, yeah. And the interesting thing about Betsy is that we can debate these things, and we have very, very firm ideas, each of us, but we, you know, can agree to disagree on these things. But what is really interesting is the dialogue that, you know, we have when we're both, you know, fighting our own corner, as it were. She's not somebody who would be, you know, upset by you disagreeing with her, but you know, she welcomes this sort of dialogue, and yeah, for sure, we've had some, you know, very, very in-depth conversations. But because we have this mutual respect for each other's work, it means that, you know, it's okay. We're both okay with how we approach things. And I have learned things from her. I don't know if she's learned things from me, but I certainly have. You know, she opens my eyes to different ways of thinking about stuff. And she's really, really a fabulous individual. And she's a fabulous person in general.
I think so, too. And I have to ask, because many of my people have become addicted, and I'm wondering, has she turned you on to beating? Are you kind of obsessed with it the way that, say, Lisa at my staff is, or, you know, some of the other people that I know?
I want to explore it, and I'm sure after this weekend she'll get me going again on adding beads to my work. I haven't become completely obsessed with it, but she definitely sparks other ideas. So it might not be actually adding beading, but it's the approach and some of the technique and so on. And I just think she has better eyesight than I do as well.
Well, if she gets you going, we are thinking about a 12-step program in case.
Okay, yeah.
All right.
Definitely need that.
Yeah, you really do. Yeah. All right. I want to digress here a little bit from the fiber arts world, because you know, you are a very interesting person, and besides being a designer, an author, a teacher, you really are an artist. You know, I'd like to talk to you about your other creative endeavors. The first one, of course, I want to talk about is you're a painter, and I know that that's really important to you. Can you talk to us about your painting?
Yeah, and it's something that I'm just on a little hiatus from, but I will get back to. But I paint in watercolor, and it's actually kind of funny to me that I do what they call intuitive things. So you put down color onto the paper and then look for what you see there and you know, start working into it there so that the shapes that are formed remind you of something. And my little background here is that, you know, my mother loves flowers. Everything she has, you know, like floral wallpaper and the fabrics she wears, her teacups and everything, you won't find a flower. I'm just looking around. No, there are no flowers in my house. but when I do this intuitive thing, guess what I paint? Flowers. Do you think maybe I'm repressing something? but I like to think that my flowers have attitudes, that, you know, they're not just little cutesy little flowers. They're big, bold, sort of O'Keefe-esque. They're nowhere near as good as hers by any stretch of the imagination, but they have that sort of, like, you really stick your face right into a flower and looking at them really close up. And so they're not botanicals. They're not like you could recognize this flower. They're just out of my imagination. But what I have learned from painting has informed my color work. So I call it, it's kind of funny, I call it cross-pollination, which is funny now I think about it with the flowers. But whenever I do something that is creative in another way outside of my work, it informs what I'm doing with my work as well. So there's like this cross-pollination between the two mediums, which I find really, really exciting.
Well, you know, I have no artistic ability whatsoever, so I'm always amazed about this. But I think, you know, one of the other things that I think is just really fun that I'm hoping that you'll share with Fiber Hooligans is you're a dancer, too. And
yeah.
I'd like you to tell them about your dancing, because it's great. It's great.
Yeah. I've danced since I was a girl. Both of my cousins were dance school teachers, and so I kind of took to it at a very early age. And I've dabbled in all sorts of different types of dance, but currently my big thing is belly dancing, which I'm loving to death, and you get to dress up and wear lots of sparkly things and and it be very, very feminine. It's really a lot of fun.
Well, and so do you take classes? Do you
perform?
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, there are a few schools here in Toronto, but I take classes, and you know, of course, you end up sort of admiring the instructors. And surprisingly enough, a lot of my friends from class, I've discovered, are knitters as well. I think there's some correlation between this. One Christmas, I walked in, and everybody's still trying to finish up the projects they're going to give to people for Christmas. And I was like, wow, you guys all knit as well. And then they found out who I was. So now there's a whole belly dance group on Ravelry. And so, you know, we're all friends through Ravelry as well. But yeah, I take classes, and then they put on galas twice a year, so you get to perform in public with your classmates. And one of the things that one of my instructors taught me, which I still use, and I'm hoping this doesn't happen during the opening day presentation, but you know, there's moments where maybe things aren't going quite as well as you hoped, and in dance terms, you know, you suddenly forget the choreography or you've turned the wrong way from everybody else. She said, all you have to do is smile and shake something. And, you know, people will so yeah, you have to show up now on opening day to see if I smile and shake something. But, you know, people respond to the recovery much more than they will if you have, you know, you fluffed something. You see ice dancers who take the most horrible tumble, but they get back up and they continue. You're really admiring, you know, of them because they got the grit and determination to get back up with probably some pretty nasty bruises and pain, but they carry on. So it's that recovery idea of, you know, just don't freeze there and do nothing. Perform, you know, keep going. Smile and shake something. It's my new motto.
Smile and shake something. Your new motto, smile and shake something. I just got a text from Betsy. Got to read it. I won't read it all, but she actually used a hash symbol on it. Pound permanently blushing. Yes, Betsy, you're not safe. No conversation you have with me is safe. We love you, Betsy.
Oh, that's great.
Yep. So the belly dancing thing, you and I had a quick talk about it, and I want you to explore it just a little longer, if you would, please. And it's about some empowerment, too. This is a part of why you do it.
Sorry, I missed one word there. It's about?
This is about some empowerment as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think oftentimes the notion about belly dancing is about, you know, it's about titillation, and it's about, you know, men ogling women. But what I think when I have come to this art form is that really it's about women owning their own physical self. And so that, you know, it doesn't matter what shape you are. It's really, you know, you're trying to hone your techniques, but it's an expression of yourself. And sure, you're wearing kind of probably a skimpy costume so that you can see the muscle groups working and the isolations and that kind of thing. It's not about, you know, bearing yourself so that people can look at your body in that sort of titillation way. But really it's about the feminine and being an empowered woman and owning your physical enjoyment of this art form. And so I don't think that it's that kind of, what should we say? You know, everybody thinks that it's just about, you know, shaking things so that men look at you. But it's really about, no, this is who I am as a woman, and I'm expressing my feelings here. And I think that is what is attractive about it, that, that you know, people look really beautiful when they're dancing because they're very happy with themselves.
Well, I think that's great. I'm glad you brought that out because I think that this translates into many things that you do. I think that you're always trying to empower people and always, and I think you're doing it for the right reasons. And so I'm glad we get to use that metaphor on your work.
And we have to learn to empower ourselves too in order to be able to pass that on and keep it, you know, like filling the well to generate more so that you can pass it on. So I think that's kind of where the dancing fits in for me. And just it's such a lot of fun, and you get to hear such cool music and, you know, the camaraderie of the class. And it's, yeah, I love it.
That's fantastic. And I just love how well-rounded you are. It's just every time I learn more about you, you're just more and more interesting. I love it.
Well, thank you. Well-rounded, yes. I'm sure there's still things, yes, muscles I should work on, you know. But
well, that's... And again, I got tagged, folks. She's just far too clever to have, you know, to be sparring with, I tell you. So are there any shout-outs that you'd like to give to anyone or reminders about anything that you're working on?
Yeah, one of the new things, actually, I just got a message this morning from Sarah Demon that Plucky Knitter Yarns, I'm just working on some new patterns for them. The first one of them is about to be launched, so I'm really excited to be working with some of these sort of indie yarn companies and dyers. And there are more things like that in the works, but I'm going to keep some of those under my hat for now. But that's the latest venture that I'm dabbling with. And I also just on the weekend did the final edits for the pattern that is going to be in the winter issue of Twist Collective, so I'm super excited to see that. I haven't seen the photographs of it yet, so I don't know what it looks like on the models, but I'm pretty pleased with the design. So yeah, they're the latest things that are coming from me in the next couple of months.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm going to be looking for all of that. So as we're winding down here, I asked this of all my guests, and I gave you fair warning that I was going to ask this so you could have a chance to think about it before we wrap this up.
And Steve also gave me a heads up last week, too. He said that you always
good.
Ask.
Yep. Before we wrap this up, I'd like to ask you if you have a final message that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Sure. So I've talked about, you know, a lot about trying to inspire people. But one of the things that I like to use are quotes from other artists. And interestingly, one of my favorites is from Martha Graham, who was a choreographer. So it speaks nicely, fits rather nicely in with that whole idea about dance. So this is one of my go-to quotes. And I often use a lot of this in my creativity classes. So I'm just going to read it to you because her words are much better than mine would be. So if I paraphrase it, it wouldn't be nearly so pretty. So I'm going to just read from her quote. So she says, "There is a life, there is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and will be lost." So I remind myself of this on those days where you're sitting in a corner going, I don't like my work. Okay, get up and do this, because if I don't do it, it will never exist. And I try and encourage all of my students and people that I interact with to remember that, you know, we can't be anybody else. We have to be ourselves. But if we block this idea and we, you know, that we worry about not being able to create something, you know, that's going to be the next Sistine Chapel or whatever, there could be this potential there. If Michelangelo had blocked whatever he was, you know, demons and angst he had, then we wouldn't have had the David or the Sistine Chapel and, you know, fill in the blanks there. So many, you know, versions of that.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, that truly is beautiful.
Yeah, it is. That's why I always use her words, because I wouldn't do it nearly so much justice, but I think it is. It's really beautiful, and we all have to remember that. I had been mentioning it, sharing it with a friend just before I saw Eric Clapton perform one time, and I was sitting in the concert thinking of all of the things that he went through in his life. There have been lots of times when he could have probably just quit and not carried on, and we wouldn't have his music if he had succumbed to, you know, some of the dreadful things that have happened, loss of his son and so on. So we all have to, you know, just keep getting back up and trying again.
Well, I don't think it ends much better than that, so I'm going to bring this interview to an end, and I want to thank you again for joining us, Fiona. I'll look forward to seeing you in a few days at Stitches East in Hartford.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun and you know, giving me that chance to prattle on about my own thoughts. So, thank you, Benjamin.
Well, first of all, it wasn't prattle. It was wonderful. Second of all, I think I speak for all fiber hooligans. We just want to wrap ourselves up in your accent.
Yeah, that's always that, right? It's fake, did you know?
All right.
This is what
you,
I wish you I could
a...
do in America.
You
That's
have a
what
great
I wish
day,
to do in American accent. Sorry, go ahead.
You have a great, you have a great day, and I'll see you later this week.
All righty. Thanks so much, Benjamin.
Bye. That was the very talented Fiona Ellis. You can keep up with Fiona and what she's doing at FionaEllisOnline.com, and that's one you're going to want to bookmark. This week, we are going to continue our new segment from our roving virtual reporter to tell us about the things she's seen in the fiber arts world and what she thinks we should know about or just whatever she wants to talk about. I'd like to welcome back the moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group and Fiber Hooligans Facebook group, my friend and fellow Fiber Hooligan, Tammy Burke. Tammy joins us from Boise, Idaho this morning. Good morning, Tammy, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. Yes, let's try to do that. I think that Kelly's idea last week about remembering to say Happy Monday is a good thing. You remind me to do that, okay, Tammy?
I will.
So it's been a busy week here. Obviously, you know, we've got nothing going on later this week, so, you know, we've just been, you know. I'm sure you've been doing some planning and some packing yourself.
Yes, I've been all over the website looking at all the studying up for stitches.
Oh, okay. So what would you like to talk about? What would you like to share today?
Well, I'm looking at the show book for Stitches East, and I've been looking at different comments. I've been following the Ravelry group, the forum about Stitches East, and you know, going through all the wonderful posts that the vendors have been posting, because I like to hang out in the marketplace. I don't know if you've got a chance to look at that, and I recommend everybody do. The Erin Lane, Lindsay Martin, that we've had on the show before, she's been posting these great poems about her projects using Dr. Seuss-style poems. Totally.
Yeah, they're
awesome.
Great. And yeah, Tammy's talking about on Ravelry, we have a group, the Stitches East group, and there is a vendor sponsor preview thread where I encourage all of the vendors who are going to the market to show pictures of pretty yarn and talk about their products and talk about any specials they're doing. And it's turned into be one of the more active threads that we have on our groups, and there's a great job that people are doing up there right now. It's very pretty stuff. So if you're getting jazzed or you just need, you know, a pre-Stitches East market fix, I really invite you to go up there.
And I've been studying the show book, and I'm going to go to the library today and print out my passport for the marketplace. And, you know, I'm studying up. So I have a bunch of questions for you.
Okay, well, we'll take our time today, and we'll do a little Q&A about what you need. So what can I help you with?
So I haven't been to any of the Stitches anywhere, and I'm wondering, looking at all this information, is there a difference, is there a different kind of a feel between, like, Stitches East and Stitches West, or, you know, a different kind of mentality between Stitches Midwest and Stitches in Atlanta at the West Show?
There absolutely is. I think that there is a really different feel for each show. I mean, of course, we have people that come to the shows and fly in from all over, and they come to maybe several, or, you know, they say, okay, I live in Texas, but I really like going to the Hartford show, and so that's the show they do, you know, whatever that it is. But definitely, they're still very much regional shows. And so when we're in Atlanta, you know, we have more people that are coming from the South, and also more, I think, probably international people, because Atlanta is an international hub. So there's a different feel. The South Show is very relaxed and just a little smaller. The East Coast Show is a little more busy, and the Midwest Show is kind of our backyard, and it's a big, beautiful venue. The West Coast Show is crazy. It is, you know, it's almost as big as all these other Stitches put together. You have to train for the West Coast Show. They all have a different feel, and a lot of the feel has to do with, you know, the surroundings. You know, can you go out and eat in the evenings? Is there any cute little bistros? And just the people that come. Having said that, there's people there that I see every single time, some of my favorite vendors and sponsors and teachers and even attendees that I see every single time. So it's like having four great different venue location vacations with some really, really good friends.
That sounds pretty cool. Do you think the West is different so much from the others because it's so far away from all the others?
I don't. I think that the West is big because I think it's just in a good geographical area, and we managed to keep it in the same spot and not move it for many years, and that helps a show to grow. We've had good partners out there. You know, the East Coast Show has moved a lot. And when things move a lot, you know, and it's unfortunate. You know, I love for shows to stay in the same area so people could get used to them. But, you know, occasionally, you know, a venue doesn't work out or you can't grow into it or there's a problem. And so, you know, it just is the way it is. I probably
that's
don't
something
have
I
a favorite. Go ahead.
That's something I would have never known about. That's something I would have never known, never having been to one, is how much more relaxed perhaps the California location is.
Well, I'm not sure it's the most relaxed. I think the one place that we usually kind of melt into the sofas is the Midwest show, just because it's our backyard. Most of us can drive to it. It's a little less stress for us, but I can't speak on behalf of the attendees for that.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to all of these. I've been invited to go with Steve Malcolm's It Takes Balls to Knit team. I'm looking forward to going to Marley's PJ party at Stitches East this weekend and the fashion show. And now that we've talked with Fiona so much about this Raglan program that's going to be on, what else do you think I should be looking for?
Well, okay, so the problem with Stitches, and it's not a problem, is that you really can book yourself so you have no time at all. You really can. We have a thing called the Works Package where people can take all these classes and all the events. I recommend you go to the events. I recommend that you go to opening day and opening day lunch. I recommend that you go to the fashion show and the fashion show dinner and the student banquet and Marley's. The evening events, those are worth doing. During the course of the day, there's lots of stuff going on in the market, and there's a lot of classes going on. I mean, there's always a book signing or a demo going on in the market, and there's always, you know, a flash sale that happens. You know, there's a lot going on just during the day, even if you're not taking classes. But one of the things that I really want to encourage people to do is slow their roll just a little bit. Find yourself a small corner with a bunch of knitters that you don't know, knitters or crocheters. I want to make sure, knitters or crocheters. How about knitters and crocheters? Let's do that. Knitters and crocheters. Sit down with them and start a conversation. One of the most amazing things that people can take away from this weekend is not they learned or the brand new skein of hand-dyed yarn, but lifelong friendships. I've seen it happen. You know, I always encourage people, give your chance to make the next best friend you've ever had.
Yeah. Well, I've admired so many of the people that you've had on the show, and so many of them are going to be at this event. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody in person. The second time, you and I will get to see each other in person, so that's awesome, too.
It is awesome. We have not seen each other since Sock Summit, which is a long time ago.
Yeah. Was that 2011? I think so.
It probably was. Yeah, it was probably 2011. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you. I mean, I Skyped with you the other day, but that's or a Google Hangout with you the other day, but that's different.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And I got to ask, so this is my turn to ask you, are besides Fiona, any other celebrity knitters or knitterati out there that you're stalking?
Well, I've been listening to Marley's program since she was on your show, so way back was that episode 3, 2, something?
Yeah, right around there.
So I'm looking forward to seeing her in person. I'm also looking forward to meeting Drew Imborski. I've never met him. There's just so many of them. I can't begin. I tried making a list the other day, and it filled up the page. So obviously I'm looking for everybody. I'm looking to see everybody. I'm hoping to be able to get hugs and give hugs to lots of people that I know that are going to be there and super wore out from getting ready, but also, you know, so I'm sure that I'll see lots of smiles on folks from getting to see that look forward to being there and get to see everybody else too.
Absolutely. And I'm going to give you one other piece of advice that I want to give
okay.
to anybody who's listening, maybe as a first-timer. It can be overwhelming.
Awesome.
The market can be overwhelming.
Yes.
And meeting all these, you know, celebrity teachers and these yarn company owners can be overwhelming. You know, the favorite hand dyer can be overwhelming. I mean, just all these people can be overwhelming. And there are those moments of shy that I want you to really struggle against. I can't tell you how many times I've been in an elevator and somebody kind of nodded to me and looked down at the floor, and then I got a message later, hi, I don't know if you met me. I sort of saw you in the elevator, but I was too shy to say hello. Those are missed opportunities. Nobody there at the show doesn't want to be told, hey, I'm so-and-so, I like your stuff, it's good to meet you. make sure that you, everybody, get over your shyness and walk up to your knitting and crochet heroes and make the introduction.
And you know me, and our listeners probably don't know the story, but that was exactly the case that happened when I met you. Thank you for that advice. I really needed it. I'm a little bit awestruck when I see people that I've been following for a long time, and I think that's probably where a lot of that comes from most people. But what I have found is that fiber folk, generous and caring and humane people that you could run across, and you know, that's one thing that I've learned about online, following all these people like Pam with Halos and all of our different friends. Yes, Pam, we are all just people.
That's absolutely, and as Pam just said in the chat room, we all put their pants on just like you do. Oh well, I mean, I'm not gonna ask how you put your pants on, Tammy. So we're gonna leave that one alone. Pam, don't get me in trouble here.
I will be walking around the marketplace with my knitting in hand. I tend to knit as I stroll, so I'm hoping to churn out some. At least a couple of hats for Halos of Hope while we're there, so I'm hoping that if anybody sees me or would like to say hello to me, that they will feel the same way about coming up to meet me, and we can just hang out. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody that loves fiber.
Well, that's fantastic, and I really appreciate your question. Did you have anything else you wanted to share with us today, Tammy?
No, I'll see everybody in 2 weeks.
Well, that's great, and thanks for coming on again, and I will see you later this week.
Yes.
Our roving virtual Fiber Hooligan reporter and moderator of our Fiber Hooligans Facebook group and Fiber Hooligans Ravelry group. For those of you who may have missed anything in this podcast, I invite you to join us on those groups. Tammy does a great job of making sure we answer questions and provide follow-up to anything you might ask about the show. Excuse me. Next Monday, there will not be a show. I'll be flying back from Stitches East, and I'll be at the show most of this week, so I just don't have the time to prepare for it. On the 18th, we'll be back with a very special guest, Heather Ardover. Heather is a writer, knitter, designer, podcaster, spinner, weaver, mother, tutor, and all-around interesting person. I've listened to her podcast and read her last book. She's eloquent and funny, and I know you're going to love her. I cannot wait to have her on the show so I can share this interview with all of you. I want to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, I may even read your email or message on the podcast. Well, that's our show, Fiber Hooligans. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. The good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. We'll see you in 2 weeks for another edition of Fiber Hooligans.